Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Mind Matters. Mental health was the focus of this year's Day of Life celebrated by the Catholic Church in England and Wales, with statistics saying that one in four people will experience a mental health problem at some stage in their life. Avoiding abuse. How safe is the US Church for young people? A leading Catholic psychologist assesses the effectiveness of screening measures adopted in the wake of the 2002 clerical child sex abuse scandal. And going across. With the 2008 World Youth Day in Sydney just around the corner, we report on the journey of the cross and the icon across Australia in the run-up to this global event. The bishops of England and Wales are reminding the faithful that mental illness can happen to anyone, even good Catholics. Mental health was the theme of this year's Day of Life celebrated last weekend in the Diocese of England and Wales. In a message released ahead of the day, the bishops noted that one in four people will experience a mental health problem at some stage in their life and said they wanted to raise awareness of the needs of those affected by mental ill health, plus their family and their carers. Sheila Hollins is a Catholic professor of psychology and a former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in the UK. She talked to me about her reactions to the Church's decision to dedicate this year's Day of Life to the issue of mental health.
I think it was a brilliant choice and a very well-timed choice, because mental health, or living with mental ill health, really does detract from one's quality of life. And to be able to live a full life, one does need to have very good mental health.
Mental health problems are far more common than perhaps many people would think, aren't they? I gather that one in four will experience a mental health problem at some stage in their life. Do you think people aren't perhaps aware of this?
Absolutely. But if you ask somebody who in their family has had or currently has a mental disorder, and then explain what is included in that term, mental disorder, nearly every family will have somebody who, for example, an elderly person with dementia, somebody who's recently retired or been made redundant, who is depressed, somebody who's anxious, has an obsessional compulsive disorder, somebody with postnatal depression, somebody experiencing severe stress, which is really interfering with their ability to work and live a normal life. Maybe a child or an adult with a severe learning disability, or with autism, somebody with an alcohol addiction or a substance misuse problem, a teenager with an eating disorder. These are all mental disorders.
So of these mental health problems that you've just listed there, what are the most common nowadays?
There are common mental disorders such as depression and anxiety, and alcohol problems, alcohol misuse. Those are probably the most common. Of course, people are living later in life now, and the number of people experiencing dementia is going up. So with people who are over 85, one in five will have dementia. So there are some very common mental disorders. Learning disability or intellectual disability is something which about 3% of the population will have a learning disability such that they need extra help to live an ordinary life.
And what kind of strides have been made in treating mental health problems? Because some of them, of course, are very intractable, particularly, let's say, dementia. I mean, you can sort of mitigate a bit the effect or the speed of the onset, but there's no cure, is there?
No, but cure isn't what it's all about. However, I would like to say a little bit about cure and what we call prognosis, you know, what the likely outcome of the condition is. Mental disorders actually have a much better prognosis than most people think. I'll give you an example. If you have a first episode of schizophrenia, you've got a better outcome than if you have a first episode of diabetes, for example. A quarter of people who have a first episode of schizophrenia will not have a second episode. A lot of people assume that once you've got a mental illness or a mental disorder of some kind, that it's that you can't treat it and that there's nothing you can do. And also, people sometimes think, particularly people of faith, think that all they've got to do is to pray about it, be a better Christian, for example, and that if they do that, then all will be well, the difficulties they're experiencing will go away. That's just not true. Mental disorders, many mental disorders are conditions which have quite a strong medical component to them, and there are effective treatments. It might involve using medication, it might involve psychological therapies, talking treatments, but many of these conditions do respond quite well to treatment. But there are other disorders which are very difficult illnesses to live with. And bipolar disorder, what's sometimes called manic depression, is a condition which often does recur, sometimes after a long gap, a long time without any symptoms. But again, there are good treatments, and providing a person has very good treatment and very good support, both from kind of family, from friends, but very good support from community-based mental health professionals to help them when their symptoms do recur, then again, the outcome can be good.
And how actively involved is the Catholic Church in helping to care for those suffering from mental health problems or providing support for their families?
Well, the Catholic Church isn't immune from the same kinds of discrimination that the rest of society show, unfortunately. And there's a lot of stigma still attached to mental disorders. You'll probably remember years ago there was a huge stigma attached to cancer. That stigma seems to have gone. People will now talk about cancer. They will say that they've got cancer, but very few people actually admit to having depression or an obsessional disorder or an addiction. They keep it quiet. People are ashamed still of having those kinds of conditions. And I don't think that we have enough openness and enough information within church communities to be able to provide the appropriate kind of support. So people are uncomfortable. They don't ask after somebody who is unwell or somebody whose son or daughter is unwell if it's a mental disorder, in the same way that they would if it was a physical disorder. And that is that can isolate somebody even further and make living with depression or schizophrenia that much harder.
So you're saying that there is, in fact, this quite wide tendency on the behalf of, say, the public at whole, the people who are well, to rather steer clear of those suffering from mental health problems. They don't want to get involved, they feel uncomfortable, they don't know what they can do.
That's right, and that is true within church communities as well. And you know, all of us are vulnerable, so it might be the parish priest who is depressed. It may be that it's one of the readers. It may be that it's somebody who's not well known in the church community and doesn't feel welcome in that community. But they are so common. In any 1 year, one in six of us will have a mental disorder. And there is a range from very common mental disorders, which are quite mild, some of which may well clear up on their own, right through to disorders which are really going to interfere with somebody's ability to lead an ordinary life. And those people are going to be sitting in church, coming to church, or perhaps not coming to church, and not joining in parish activities. And I think church communities could do so much, actually, to break down some of the stigma and discrimination that people experiencing mental disorders face.
Can you give us some inspirational or heartwarming anecdotes about some patients you have dealt with who have managed to successfully overcome their mental health problems, who've had a happy ending, as it were?
Yes, I could tell you the story of somebody I've been working with whilst I've been president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. She has appeared with me on a television programme, so the story that I will tell you has already been made public by her. But this is a woman who's had schizophrenia for 18 years now, and throughout the early stages of her illness, she continued in her quite high-powered job And during this time, when she became ill, on a number of occasions, she was sectioned under our mental health legislation. This meant that either a mental health professional or, on occasion, the police would come and to see her and to take her to hospital, something that clearly at the time she was too ill to understand that she was unwell and didn't want to go to hospital. And she says, when I would go to the hospital, there would come a moment when I would be very grateful for the fact that I was there, because I would realize that people were looking after me, keeping me well. And then the time would come when I would want to get out, when I really had decided that I'd had enough of being in hospital and that I was now ready to go back home. And she said some of the difficulties that she then had to face were decisions about what medication to take, side effects of the medication not always so good. She now works as a freelance advisor and consultant about the experience of living with a mental illness, and she works as a kind of service user and advocate for other people with severe mental illness, living a very full life, aware that her illness might recur, but able to talk to people and to be involved in training health professionals about how best to support and look after people with schizophrenia. So I think that's a lovely story.
Yes, indeed. And what made you decide to specialise in this field of healthcare, and how rewarding, or what are the best rewards of your job?
I graduated from medicine and decided to become a general practitioner. And in fact, I had never really studied any psychiatry. It wasn't compulsory in my medical school. And when I became a GP, I began to realize that about half of the people who came to see me were people with emotional and mental disorders. And I had not been trained to know how to work with them. So after 3 years in general practice, not feeling properly competent, be able to look after their needs, I decided that I would train in psychiatry, always intending to go back to general practice. But I loved it, absolutely loved it. I think it's the best career. And I would encourage any young person thinking of going to medical school to really seriously consider a career in psychiatry. 1 in 10 medical students in the United Kingdom, and this will be true around the world because these conditions are so common, but 1 in 10 UK medical students needs to choose psychiatry as a career to fill the post of psychiatrist. And that's more psychiatrists than surgeons, for example. And yet there is quite a lot of stigma attached to those sorts of career decisions, which is partly connected to the whole issue of discrimination about mental illness.
That was Sheila Hollins, former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in the UK. And it all goes down in your mind. 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 It all goes down in your mind. In the US, how safe is the church for young people, and how effective are the measures taken in the wake of the 2002 child sex abuse scandal? Avoiding the tragedy of another abuse crisis was the guiding principle behind a series of preventative and child protection measures that were taken by the church authorities in the wake of the 2002 scandal, when it emerged that more than 4,000 US priests had been accused of abusing minors since the 1950s. But 6 years on from then, how effective are the current screening methods that were adopted to stamp out the risk of child sex abuse within the church? A leading US Catholic psychologist believes the best approach for avoiding another sexual abuse scandal in the church is to prevent candidates with tendencies towards paedophilia from becoming priests. Psychologist Phil Scrofani is the speaker at an upcoming seminar in Virginia that will address the need for psychological expertise when working with candidates for the priesthood. Dr. Scrofani is Director of Clinical Training at the Catholic Institute for the Psychological Sciences in Arlington, Virginia. I began by asking him how effective the current screening methods are at seminaries in the U.S.
Well, the screening process has improved immensely since the scandal, and in some seminaries, I might say, even prior to the scandal. The screening processes are now very thorough. They utilize psychologists who have extensive expertise in the process of screening. They tend to use complete, full batteries of psychological testing where they did not in the past, and they utilize very complete what we call developmental interviews where we not only look at the psychological development of the person, but also their psychosexual maturity. How effective we are, I guess time will tell, but it seems like there's every indication that the effectiveness has improved immensely.
Is there any other further improvements that you would like to see taken, you know, that you are suggesting should be taken?
Yes, I think that we should look at the process of follow-through. That screening itself is not sufficient. That's a good first step, but there should be careful monitoring of seminarians throughout their preparation, always with an eye on how mature they are, the kinds of relationships that they're maintaining as seminarians, that kind of thing. And of course, there needs to be training of young priests, and even, I should say, adult practitioners on the risk factors that emerge that may lead to inappropriate relationships between adult and child. Now, how would we learn about those risk factors? Well, there are experts that can teach the kinds of parameters that one should look out for. But also, I think it's important to interview and to get to know the victims of these tragedies, those who are willing to step in and try to assist the church and help the church become a safer place by sharing their experiences and by sharing the personal vulnerabilities that made them susceptible to these kinds of abuses.
But how many of these victims are actually willing to do that, which it must be quite a painful thing to relive those experiences?
Yes, that, of course, is the great challenge. We have to find people, first of all, who aren't so embittered by the experience that they might not be willing to assist the church. But there are certainly some people who are willing to step forward and help. And yes, we have to be careful that they have sufficiently worked through their own trauma in order to be useful and of assistance to any project that would help by way of prevention.
During his trip to the U.S., Pope Benedict was very upfront and frank about apologizing for the sexual abuse scandal. And he also made a pledge to keep pedophiles out of the priesthood, saying it was more important to have good priests than many priests. Do you think that in the past this was a point that was perhaps sometimes disregarded by those in charge of the seminaries?
I think he's absolutely on target with that statement. I think in the past there was an eagerness to bring young men into the priesthood, which of course is something that we want. But I think in the effort to recruit priests, that many things that had to do with one's understanding and one's appreciation of the human person and human sexuality were not looked at thoroughly, and therefore people got into the priesthood, into seminaries at least, that were ill-suited for the task. The Arlington Diocese in Virginia has been one of the dioceses that I think followed that dictum that Pope Benedict now articulates so well. They were far more interested in getting good priests than many priests. Interestingly enough, they were rewarded by getting many of both.
Pope Benedict also said during his visit to the U.S. that in many cases this sexual abuse crisis was badly handled by the church. From a psychological viewpoint, what should the church have done and what can it do in the future to help the victims regain their trust in the church and its clergy?
Well, to begin with, I think we need a zero-tolerance posture with anything that speaks to child abuse or impropriety with regard to children, exploiting children in any way. Those policies, that attitude has to be communicated right from the beginning, with not only with seminarians, but throughout the parishes, throughout the diocese. There needs to be programs where people are sensitized to the possibility of exploitation of children. People need to be educated, both priests and lay people, adults, in the kind of risk factors that they might look for to prevent such tragedies. Yes, in the past, there was a lax attitude. I think there was a lax attitude about people's view of human sexuality and chastity. As you might recall, we went through a period, at least in the United States, and I think in most of Western Europe, where the entire culture became very laxed and relaxed about the purpose of human sexuality. And I think that found its way into seminaries and other educational institutions.
Do you think then that by his pronouncements and his repeated apologies and, of course, his unscheduled meeting with a group of victims during his visit to the US, that the Pope did a lot to help this healing process, which must, of course, be very difficult for those who've been abused in this way?
I think he made a very courageous, immense step in that regard. He was very visible to the public with his concern for the victims and for the tragedies that developed in terms of pedophilia. I think he set into motion the message that the hierarchy should be emulating what he has done. They should be stepping forward and being very visible in their dioceses and, of course, pastors in their parishes to make the public aware that we are concerned, about what happened to victims, and we are concerned about learning everything that's possible to prevent further tragedy. He's been a wonderful role model. I think what has to occur, though, is more of the same would be immensely helpful if the Holy Father continues on this path and encourages the hierarchy to do the same.
And coming back to the victims, when you've met victims of sexual abuse, what percentage of them remain highly embittered? How easy is it for them to let go, in a sense, and forgive?
I think that the probably the majority of the victims, certainly that I've met and that I've read about, are at this point concerned about achieving justice with the church, that they feel like that their rights as a human being have been terribly violated and that they want to see justice. They're very concerned about that. The process of forgiveness will probably come later for many of them. Of course, I have met a handful of people that have been victims of pedophilia that have moved into the forgiveness area and now are looking towards letting the church hierarchy know this terrible thing that happened to them and what might be done to begin to heal the wounds. But they are very much in the minority. That doesn't mean that they're not out there. It doesn't mean that there aren't people that are willing to step forward and to help.
That was Dr. Phil Scrofani, a Catholic psychologist from the Institute for the Psychological Sciences in Arlington, Virginia.
Every nation, every tribe, come together to worship you.
Pope Benedict begins a pastoral visit to Australia next week, during which he will attend the World Youth Day gathering in Sydney. Organised by the church, World Youth Day is the largest youth event in the world and brings together hundreds of thousands of young people from around the globe to celebrate and learn about their faith. In the run-up to next week's opening of the Sydney event, the World Youth Day cross and icon were taken on a 12-month-long journey across Australia. From Sydney, Catherine Smyberg reports on the impact of this journey.
Lives of Australian Catholics are changing each day in the lead-up to the World Youth Day of 2008, and never more so than since the arrival of the World Youth Day cross and icon to the host city of Sydney last July. As they travel across the Great Southland, the holy symbols are having a distinct impact upon each person that they encounter. Whether in the rural outback or along the coast of the Great Barrier Reef, the cross and icon are being warmly received as celebrated signs of peace, love and reconciliation.
For me personally, it really brings me a lot of strength. To see so many young people really getting involved in their faith.
Continuing with the cross and icon kind of keeps it all in perspective, and you know what is right and what is wrong. So I think sometimes people judge you on it, but you've felt the power of it all, so you know what is the right path. Yeah.
Each diocese across Australia has presented their own dynamic flavour for the reception of the cross and icon. The processions alone for this World Youth Day tradition have occurred on boats, helicopters and trains, with veneration happening via masses, prayer vigils and music festivals. The Aussie team of young volunteers have so far taken the 3.8-metre cross and 15-kilogram image of Our Lady over tens of thousands of kilometres.
This visit of the cross and the icon, it's the first visit to our part of Australia. It's been to about 15 other dioceses, but so this is the first experience here, and we've been preparing very assiduously to get a good reception. And I think, you know, there's been a great response, not only from our own schools and parishes, but also through the various business areas of the community.
I went to venerate the cross, and I guess that's been pinnacle point in my faith journey. I was not a Christian before that, no faith background whatsoever, and this one moment changed my life.
Australians see a chance to engage the extended community with the hope that these symbols represent, as occurred on World AIDS Day of December 1st.
This is a special occasion because we've brought together the cross, which is the symbol of courage and hope, and the issue of AIDS, which is very dear to young people. And we felt that the two coming together capture the imagination of young people in a way that we want them to bring their faith to the issues of the world today.
I think it gives us all a common way that we can all identify with each other and something that we can all share and help celebrate.
Other social justice issues have been highlighted on this journey by the Aboriginal Message Stick, which travels with the World Youth Day symbols into remote Indigenous communities.
We're much more aware now than we used to be that white settlement was only over 200 years ago, that for a long time we were in denial about a lot of that. And what's happening now is it's very, very rare if we have a function where there's no recognition of the original inhabitants.
Because the young people of this world are our future.
And overseeing these moments of reconciliation is the Queen of Peace herself, through the icon of Mary entrusted to this journey as well.
When my pain gets too much, let me fall into your loving arms. Please pick me up when I feel broken.
I think it's important to praise Mary also because she leads us to Jesus. She is the mother of Jesus. She is graceful, she is kind, she is understanding. So through her and her close connection to Jesus, and through us praying to her, to the icon as well as the cross, we are able to connect with her and to Jesus and to the Holy Family. And it's important leading up to World Youth Day.
Rescue me.
So this is just a mere taste of the enthusiasm and beauty that all pilgrims will discover as they enter their personal journeys toward Sydney 2008.
That report was by Catherine Smyberg.
We will follow to the ends of the earth.
That's all from the English program for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.